Hello and welcome to the world-famous and award-winning Driving You Crazy podcast. This is the show where we talk about all things transportation, anything that gets you from here to there. I'm the traffic anchor and the transportation reporter for Denver 7 News, Jason Luber. If you would like to contact me, you sure can on any of the contact links in the description of the show. If you wouldn't mind rating the show, I'd appreciate that as well. So, I think we all know the danger of driving in areas where wildlife might cross the road. I often see deer or elk right next to the road. At least there's one road I drive on for my way into work at 3 o'clock in the morning, and the elk are especially huge. Over the past few years, states like Colorado, where I am, have been constructing tunnels or bridges over interstates or under interstates for the wildlife to use to eliminate the conflict between them and us as we drive down the highways. Now, are those the best ways to reduce these conflict areas and to keep people and the animals safe, or are there other techniques too? Joining me now to talk about that is Dr. Nicole Fry. Nikki is an associate extension professor at Utah State University in the field of wildlife biology. She's stationed at Cedar City in southern Utah, and she has a special interest in the field of human-wildlife conflicts. Dr. Fry, thanks so much for joining me on the world-famous Driving You Crazy podcast.
Hi, thank you.
All right, so before we get into the ways to keep animal and people safe on the roads, why did this area of research interest you? Do you have some kind of conflict with animals in the past that you said, I have to figure this out?
You know, it actually came from my desire to compromise. So I feel like whenever humans and wildlife have a conflict, it doesn't have to be a bad result, that we can come up with positive solutions for both the humans and the wildlife. And it is a really challenging topic, and I guess I just really love that challenge.
Yeah, and you've published several studies looking at these wildlife vehicle conflicts, and you have one back from January of 2008 that states that there were relatively few well-designed studies that have evaluated any technique that can be used to reduce these deer vehicle collisions, especially. Why wasn't there a lot of research into this field at that point?
I think it's just very hard to design a really good study that shows a cause and effect of any things that we can do to modify human behaviors. So trying to really determine, is it that flashing light sign with the deer on it that's making people change their behavior? Or is it a sign that tells people how many collisions there have been on that stretch of road that year that changes their behavior? It's just very hard to design something that very scientifically can say without a doubt that this method is changing human behavior. Can say that it's reducing conflicts, but is it changing behavior?
And after your study, were there more studies, or did you decide, all right, now I'm going to really have to dive into this thing?
I passed on future studies on human behavior, but there other scientists have done a lot of studies that basically showed the same thing, that it's just really hard to change human behavior. They get used to those signs, they get used to modifications. And so really, the direction to go is, how do we modify wildlife behavior? If you can't modify the humans, then how do we modify the wildlife?
Right. My guest is Dr. Nikki Fry. She is with Utah State University. We're talking about wildlife crossings and the best way to keep people and animals safe. Now, in that paper back in 2008, You looked at some research for the four major techniques to reduce wildlife collisions, including reducing the number of deer. I'm sure the deer were probably not voting for that plan. reducing the number of vehicles. I'm sure drivers were not really voting for that plan either. Modifying deer behavior, as you were mentioning, and changing motorist behavior. Did you find a best solution out of those four?
Well, it wasn't reducing deer, so
and they said few.
It's really just ways that we can modify the wildlife behavior. We just can't really modify human behavior for long enough time to really have a benefit to the wildlife and to really reduce those human vehicle collisions.
So did you, so when you were looking at those different four though, what did one kind of come out on top, that there was one that was better than all the others? Did you rank them in order of, all right, this is going to be the way we're going to fix this problem?
Oh gosh. No, because every animal is different. And so you really have to say, okay, we need to find a way to make the deer not want to cross the road. And now we need to find a way to make the elk not want to cross the road. And now we need to figure out a way to make those bighorn sheep stop jumping onto the road in the middle of the night. So really, the wildlife biologists tend to kind of break it down species by species, and we figure out, okay, well, why are the deer crossing the road and to begin with, right? And we can make lots of jokes about that. Yeah. and like, okay, well, if this is why the deer and this is when the deer, what can we do to scare them away or make them want to go someplace else or make it impossible for them to get to the road? So that's kind of where this field of wildlife vehicle collision reduction is going, is like, how do we keep the animals off the road? Because humans are just going to do what humans are doing
and drive where they want to drive. And when it comes to, as you were talking about modifying deer behavior in that 2008 study, you were looking at stimuli designed to frighten deer. Is it a bad idea to try to frighten animals away from a roadway, especially trying to make them go in maybe a different migration path? Because these large animals will travel hundreds of miles to migrate, right? And they're used to these certain pathways. So if you're scaring them away from that, they're probably just going to find a new way, right?
Sure. Yeah. And these scare tactics that we were looking at the time were more like something we could put using technology that would make a noise when an animal was coming by. So like, I'm sorry, if an animal and a car were in the same place at the same time, there would be a trigger that would allow an alarm to sound or a light to sound. So something that if it were crossing area, you could put some sort of sensor that as a car came by, lights would flash and noises would go off. And for that moment in time, any animal in that area would stay put because their natural behavior is to freeze. So if you scare them, they freeze in place on the side of the road, hopefully not the middle of the road. And then the driver can go by, and then the animal can recover from its fright and then continue to cross the road. So it wouldn't be something we were changing long-term behavior, but just in the moment. And we put them in place while so that the car can go by.
But you can't ever predict how an animal will react when it is scared, right? I mean, you can't predict when anything, when somebody gets scared, you don't know if they're going to freak out and the flight or fight, right? So maybe the animal's going to fight and jump into the road and try to fight, and some might just run away. So how, I mean, you really can't predict which way they're going to go.
Which is why the study didn't work.
Yeah.
Because we couldn't, because you're right. Sometimes they froze, sometimes they ran out into the middle of the road. And we didn't really see a change in overall behavior or a tendency, maybe even for that animal to hesitate on the road before it crosses. So, yeah, most of those frightening devices we have found, biologists have found, don't really work because that response is unpredictable.
My guest is Dr. Nikki Fry. She's with Utah State University, Associate Extension Professor of Wildlife Biology. We're talking about wildlife crossings and how to keep people and animals safe here in Colorado. And I know they're in Utah, and I've seen the videos there. There's been a lot of success with using both wildlife tunnels and with wildlife bridges. I guess the trick is trying to train the animal or coax the animals into using the tunnels or the bridges, right?
Yeah, a lot of times when we know what target animal, if we know that it's really the deer that is the problem or the sheep that's the problem, we can decide whether it's more appropriate to use an underpass or more appropriate to use an overpass. And because of the research that's been going on for 20 years, we know even the dimensions that are the best for that species. And then we can use engineers and architects to figure out where in the landscape would be the most natural transition for that structure. So for example, if it's an underpass, we would put it in a low spot in the topography, like maybe where a ravine already is. And so most animals would have used that anyway. So it's a more natural process for that animal. So we try to find ways to put it into the system so that there's just a natural movement. So if it's an overpass, maybe we could put it someplace where the animals would be coming down a hill and see that overpass and just naturally run straight onto that. And I've seen that in some camera footage that they just run down the hill, they see the overpass, and they aim straight for it. But in the case that they won't naturally find it, we often put up a few miles of fencing on either side of that opening so that if an animal's coming to the road, it would kind of hit that fence and then sort of follow the fence line trying to find an opening until it discovered that crossing structure. And then once it learned, oh, this is the safe place to go, it's where it would go from now on. So once they find it and they use it successfully, they'll continue to use it successfully. And if it's a mother, she'll train her offspring to use it. And so over time, you just have this increased passage rate through that structure.
You really are influencing then animal behavior at that point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure.
And I'm sure when the animals are in the tunnel or on a bridge, they probably don't know any difference, right? It's not like they're saying to each other, hey, come on over here and look over the edge. Look at all those cars down there.
Yeah, they're really not. There are definitely federal standards about how wide an overpass should be based on how long it is, how many spans of highway it's crossing. And then we can actually use like rocks and logs and things like that to make it look more natural. And most of the times, the animal just kind of crosses right over. We do see that there's a time of day sort of difference. Like if it's the time of day where there's heavy traffic, we're not going to get a lot of crossings because the traffic noise is so loud. But as the traffic volume dies down, you'll just see those animals crossing more and more. Yeah.
And you would think that the animals would be crossing at off-peak times because they're probably crossing more at night and or dawn and dusk where maybe not as many folks are out driving around.
Yep, exactly. That's exactly right. So it kind of goes naturally with that animal behavior. And then in those situations, like in the winter time where it does get dark earlier and we do have commuter traffic, yeah, those animals will still cross it because it's dark and they feel safe and it's part of their natural behavior.
Would a wildlife bridge or a tunnel, obviously it works over an interstate where you have a large crossing to get to for the animals to go over or under, but would it work in a more suburban environment where you have, like in my situation, where it's a two-lane road, there's no street lights, it's like in this park area basically where these animals are naturally hanging out. There's a huge herd of like 100 elk, and they are right next to the road and they are monster animals, and so I gingerly go through there every time I do. But is there a way to make that safer in a more suburban environment?
You know, those environments do tend to be more difficult to manage the crossings. And a lot of times, like if you just have this massive herd of elk just hanging out on the side of the road, there's really not a structure that's going to lend itself to that. And so we try to do more habitat modification. So make that side of the road less attractive to the elk, so that they just don't want to be there anyway. So maybe make it rocky or take out the trees or make it look like someplace where a mountain lion would want to hang out. And then we would also, we tend to have work with the departments of transportation, have the speed limits lowered so that people have to go slower.
People are going to really pay attention to that. They don't pay attention now.
I know. It's hopeful. But yeah, in those situations, we just want to try to get the animals away from the side of the road as much as possible. And you know, in states like Colorado and Utah and in the West, if you notice, we try not to put down salt along the roads to melt snow anymore because the wildlife are coming to the sides of the road to eat the salt. So we've gone away from doing things like that would attract wildlife to roadsides. Or you might see that they've come through and they've mowed 15 to 20 feet on either side of the road because they don't want deer or the elk to come there to eat food. So we try to keep them away from the roads as much as possible.
My guest is Dr. Nikki Fry. She's with Utah State University. We're talking about wildlife crossings and how to keep people and animals safe. And in places where let's say you couldn't put the bridge, the tunnel, you can't do some of these things. Now, over in Golden, Colorado, They put in this flashing light warning system for drivers, and basically what it does is it detects an animal, and it, like you said, there are some fencing areas, and it funnels the animal to this, these animals to the one crossing where they like to cross anyway. And so as soon as it detects the animals, it, the, their lights start flashing for the drivers, and so then maybe they get the heads up that, hey, there, there could be animals at least near the road, if not in the road. Is that one of those techniques that, that you find that might be more effective than others?
Yes. So that's what I would call a form of dynamic messaging. So things that just stay static, like the blinky light on the signs always there, eventually we don't notice it anymore, right? But if it only comes on and it's very loud, like not loud vocally, but loud visually, and you know that it's because and directly because there's an animal somewhere nearby, that tends to work because people can then learn, okay, this is a sign of danger. Because more than likely, when they see that flashing light, they can look up and find the animal. That's the cause of that reaction too. So there's a direct cause and effect there. And so humans tend to listen to that warning sign a little bit more. I have seen success on dynamic word signs that say caution, high collision area, or caution, migration route in effect, you know, things like that. And they tend to work on the human behavior side of things a little bit more than the sign that's always there.
Recently, there was a very large earthquake in Asia. And I was watching a video where somebody was driving on this mountain road, and in their car, they got a warning, a lot like the emergency warnings that we get through our phones, right? That all of a sudden start blaring for a Amber Alert or something like that. And it was an earthquake alert. And he was in a mountain area, and they had designed these stopping places, these tunnels, basically, where you could stop and then protect yourself from falling rocks and that sort of thing. It was an interesting concept, and I would think there could be maybe some benefits with wildlife as well, where you might have a situation where you have wildlife next to the road, a trigger warning sends an alert to your phone in your car if you're within a mile radius, something like that, and might alert you to this wildlife hazard.
You know, you should really go into this business. I think you'd be very successful.
I'm just an idea person. I don't know how to do it.
But definitely things like that are, they're being trying thought out right now, where like, can we use a Bluetooth transmission? So when this deer sign starts blinking because there's wildlife, can that trigger a Bluetooth transmission that then goes to your car or your phone? So this technology is certainly new, but it's being thought out, and we're definitely trying to come up with ways to do that. I don't know of a situation yet, so you could really get in on the ground floor of that. And
there you go. I'm just the idea. I like to give ideas, and I only ask for 10%. So see, you're the real expert here. See, I drive around in an electric car, and I noticed that that since it runs so quietly, with most of the sound just coming from the tires, animals don't notice me as much as if I was in a regular car, especially the loud trucks and that sort of thing, or a motorcycle. So it seems to me that I'm almost in more conflict with a animal than would be in a regular traditional ICE car, the internal combustion engine car. Do you think that's a growing concern for you as a wildlife biologist and for others that are seeing more electric cars on the road, and we could see more of these conflicts?
Yeah, absolutely. I think we have two things that we are concerned about is animals can hear your vehicle and can react, and especially animals that's part of their home range, that road, they get used to the vehicles and the sound of the vehicles. And so if they can't hear, then they have no warning that the car's coming. Yeah. And then combined with that, a lot of animals can't perceive the speeds that we go. So there's nothing in their natural world that goes 80 miles an hour or goes 70 miles an hour. So they can't see a car and conceive of it going as fast as it's going. And then you combine that with the fact that it's silent. That's a huge conservation problem, particularly for not just larger bodied animals, but smaller animals that tend to be along the sides of the roads that and that can't move fast. Like in Colorado, I'm sure you guys are familiar with porcupines.
Oh,
Like they
sure.
can't move fast, right? And so big 70 mile per hour vehicle comes up on them suddenly, they can't react that fast.
Yeah. And I would think that these small animals are also, I mean, we're talking a lot about the larger animals, but these smaller ones, like you said, you're not trying to really direct all of those because there isn't as much danger to the human or damage to the human, and therefore I don't want to say they don't count as much, but it almost seems like they don't count as much.
Yeah, you're right. It's all of our estimates on the costs of collisions come from insurance claims. So it's always if there's no vehicular damage or bodily injury to a human, we don't even know that these are happening unless you have a Department of Transportation that is going along these routes and counting these collisions. So it can be a huge conservation loss to these species. And there are natural resource economists that can come up with that number of what it means to conservation and to ecosystem services for losing those species in the environment. But it's harder for us as a society to understand the cost of a conservation loss than it is to say, yeah, that's going to be a $2,000 auto repair.
Right. But also maybe you're in that circle of life. So when a porcupine unfortunately is hit, maybe that feeds a golden eagle or feeds the coyote that comes by.
Yeah, I often talk to folks a lot about, hey, don't forget about the conservation species. We definitely have a lot of sensitive and endangered species that we're worried about that can get hit by vehicle collisions. I'm working with a national park right now that we have a threatened species that gets ran over by visitors to the national park. So how do you manage that situation unless you can put an underpass in that road and clearly, that threatened species is what people in the national park are coming to see. And so that you can definitely put a cost on that. And it's a prey species. So that means anything that was going to eat that animal now has less food. And so you just see a less robust ecosystem and an ecosystem that has less health. Then you also have with the smaller bodied animals that get hit on the road, you have a problem with predators and scavengers coming to feed on those animals, and then they get hit. And so you just have this compounding issue of loss to the ecosystem and the overall health of that area.
Right. Yeah, my guest is Dr. Nikki Fry. She's with Utah State University Associate Extension Professor of Wildlife Biology. We're talking about crossings, animal and people crossings on the road. You also published another research paper about these wildlife vehicle conflicts in March of 2010. And you were looking at the ability of drivers to detect deer, especially at night. And I found it interesting when I was reading through that you're testing, you use deer decoys. How did they help in that study?
Because what we were trying to do is make it systematic and measurable. And so we were using the deer decoys just so that we could have enough of a sample size to measure the effect of that study, and not leave it to chance that we were to find a deer. And so we could put the deer decoys at different distances from the road and measure the effect and the ability of the humans to see the deer at different distances. So because they're fake, we can move them wherever they
Right.
want.
I thought it was really interesting because you said in that study that when you located the decoys on the right side of the road, rather on the left side of the road, that it was easier to detect them. Well, I just wonder what accounted for that because when I'm driving, I notice because I'm on the left side of the vehicle, it's easier for me to see things out of my pass my driver's side window and out of the left side of the car rather than something on the right side of the car.
Yeah, I think it's I don't know because that's not something we specifically ask, but I would sus but we hypothesize that it's because it's darker in that like you don't have that the headlights are coming off your left side, right? So oncoming vehicles are coming
Yeah.
on your left side usually. And so you can you have that contrast of vision on your right side that you could see them they're not blinded by headlights.
Right. I guess it would be opposite if you're driving in Ireland.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And then, you know, that is something to test next. Like, what exactly makes that right side easier to see? But I suspect that's probably it.
Yeah.
Or maybe you're just expecting animals to come from that side, so you're subconsciously more vigilant.
Yeah. I'm almost worried about more animals coming from that right side than from the left side, because at least for me, I can almost see them a little bit better. But then again, you don't know what they're going to do, whether they're just going to wander out slowly or jump out in front of you or what they're going to do.
Yeah. And I always say it's not the one you see that's the problem. It's the other ones behind it that also want to cross that are the problem.
Exactly. We were talking about some small game animals, and I see that you do a lot of studies with the greater sage grouse. Well, why does that bird fascinate you so much?
Oh, I don't. It's an amazing species, and it's really interesting to do studies on this bird because it is throughout the entire Western United States. And it's like an indicator species almost, in that if you have healthy sage grouse populations, then you have healthy sagebrush and healthy ecosystems. And so the whole sagebrush community as a whole is healthier. And so just being able, now that the technology is better, we were able to put GPS transmitter backpacks on the sage grouse and see where they're moving. And we were really able to increase the overall knowledge we had about the species and learn about how far it can move and what other habitats it can live in and what happens if you alter the habitat. Do they leave? Do they stay there? Do they adjust? And so there was just a lot of information to discover about the species. And I always am fascinated that in the 2000s, you know, here we are 2024, and we're still learning new things about wildlife that we didn't know yet.
How do they feel about having that GPS backpack on their back?
You know, it could go either way. They do still mate. So maybe it's like shiny
hello.
Accessory. Hey, look what I got.
It's like they got the shiny new iPhone.
Yeah.
Perfect. What is next with the research? Are you going to keep looking into these? Are you going to keep doing new studies, or do you expect other folks in this field to start doing more and more studies?
I mentioned before that I'm doing this. I'm helping Bryce Canyon National Park look at how we can mitigate these vehicle collisions with the Utah prairie dog, which is a threatened species and has been on the endangered species list since before there was an Endangered Species Act. So they're living in really unique environment up there in Bryce Canyon. They get hit by the visitors. And that just attracts more prairie dogs to the scene to figure out what's going on. And that attracts more humans. So fences built under the roads, and then look at how the prairie dogs can use those underpasses. And then hopefully that will feed off into some more of these conservation uses. Two of the things that I'm doing.
Yeah. Okay, good. If you need some prairie dogs to pick up and move, we have a lot here in Colorado, and I can give them some little GPS backpacks, and they can just we could just ship them right over to you.
See, my prairie dogs like your prairie dogs. You have black-tailed prairie dogs. I have white-tailed prairie dogs.
Oh, okay.
You have black-tailed prairie dogs. They don't play well together. So,
like cats and dogs living together. I mean, seriously.
Yep,
what is the world coming to?
Who knew, right?
Dr. Nikki Fry from Utah State University, thanks again for making the additional time for me. I really enjoyed the conversation.
Thanks, you too. And if you need any more information, don't hesitate to reach out.
I have a link to Dr. Fry's contact in the description of this show. And like I told her, on my way into work at 3 o'clock in the morning, there's this one road. It's one lane each way. There's no street lights, so it's really dark. The speed limit is 45. It's a road where you could easily go much faster than that, and people do when it's daylight out. But at night, it's not recommended, at least the people who live in this area. We know that there's a lot of deer and elk that are right next to or could be right next to the road or even in the road. And those elk are huge. I saw one. There was a group maybe 60 or 70 a week or so ago right next to the road. There's one standing on a hill. There's like this little hill. It looked like a camel They're so, I mean, they're so big. They would demolish my little car and me too in the car if I hit one. So I tread lightly until I'm past the area that I know like they like to hang out at. And I tell people all the time, especially when it comes to small animals, even with big animals, don't swerve, just hit it. You're more likely to get hurt or killed if you swerve to avoid an animal, and it's much safer. Now, it's not safer for the animal, obviously, if you hit it. It's not fun or enjoyable by any means for the person who hits the animal, but it is technically safer to hit the animal rather than try to avoid it. Maybe you can slam on the brakes, especially if it's not if it's, you know, dry roads and it's not too slick, something like that. But keep that in mind, that most people get hurt or killed by trying to avoid a collision with a animal, even little ones, a squirrel or anything, because they run off the road and they crash and they roll over their car and they get thrown out or whatever. So I've hit a squirrel and a vole. I remember those little voles that chew up your yard. And I hit a bird one time. Well, I don't know if I hit it. I feel like it really wasn't my fault with the bird, because I think it was more bad flying on the bird's part than bad driving on my part. So, I mean, look, the bird didn't make it, so I guess we'll never know. But those are the only animals. That story didn't go very well, did it? But as I'm thinking about that bird that got hit, yeah, it wasn't. Look, I think a bird has plenty of space to avoid the vehicles, right? They have plenty. They have almost unlimited space up. And they didn't have to use the 10 feet that I was occupying on the ground. And so I think it's the bird's fault. You know, the squirrel and the vole, that really wasn't my fault either. They just kind of darted out, and I didn't want to hit them, but it happens. Anyway, there you go. If you need to contact me, you sure can in any of the contact links in the description of this show. Thanks again for being here. Thanks for listening. And until next time, I'm Jason Luber, the traffic guy. Be safe, and as always, happy motoring.